time, she is, both here and absent simultaneously. I crawl onto the bed and look at her, and she looks back. Blue eyes wide open, so much expression in those eyes. Then, out of nowhere, she takes her index finger and starts ever so lightly tracing the contours of my face. Over my cheeks, I have her cheeks. Around my nose, I have her nose. Her finger lingers at the tip, and she touches it a few times repeatedly. It's her way of telling me she loves me. As her finger reads my face, I know this is one of those moments that will never leave me. But now, her infection is back, and she's weaker. I enter her room the next morning to find her mouth hanging wide open, her face a fixed stare gazing off toward the window. The caregiver looks distressed, wondering if it's a stroke. Her mouth was open all night, and her tongue has dried out, and now it is bloody. A bright, red, raw spot right in the middle of the tongue. I ask the caregiver where I can find a glycerin swab to moisten her lips and tongue. I dab the spot, but it stays bloody. My mother officially looks like one of those people I remember seeing when I was a little girl, volunteering at old age homes. I tell myself that the Alzheimer's makes everything look worse. When an infection comes, the body is too taxed to complete normal cognitive functions. Her eyes won't stop watering. Her fever rages. The Clostridium difficile, or C. diff, is back. But I won't learn this until later in the day. I plan to fly home today, but I can't leave her like this. I can't make contact today, and I won't leave without making contact. I've been here now for a month, riding this line between life and death I've never been so close to before. When I was 8, my best friend Julie and I dug up her buried hamster to see what death had done to Miss Piggy. A week post-burial and Miss Piggy's body was softer. It twisted easily as I lifted her out of the shoebox, her peach fur falling out in my hands and catching the wind like thistles. I had thought digging her up merited a second funeral, and so I sprinkled her shoebox coffin with mustard blossoms and placed her back in the ground. This is about all that I know. But back at the care facility, we are still on the edge of life, but it's hovering. It could fall either way in this small, tidy room today. If it looked like death, I could follow it out. If it looked like her staying alive, I could join that too. I realize that somewhere inside me, I think I would prefer she go now, while she still knows who her loved ones are. I wonder whether this one thought might make me a horrible person. There's also something quite natural about deciding not to fight, whatever way it goes, even if it stays in a gray area, hovering indefinitely. Well, until it doesn't. I've taken to sleeping in my clothes on the couch. I am staying in the barn we built together. I sleep right next to the wood-burning stove with my back to the 13-foot-long cement table that always privately seemed, to the architects, my mother and me, more sacrificial altar than kitchen counter. We loved that. And so each day, with my back to the altar, my face to the fire, my wake-up call comes in the form of a temperature drop. When the fire dies out, the chill stirs me. I've also taken to sleeping with my shoes on. I think it's odd, but it seems easier. Why bother taking them off? I'll just have to put them on again. I haven't taken a bath in days, but my head is elsewhere. The barn well is having a challenge, so Renee tells me I can shower in her guest room, but I cannot take a bath in her yellow bathroom with the sunken tub. She tells me that my entering her bathroom would be an invasion of her private space. This hurts. I say little. I postpone the shower. It's become too loaded a topic. When the infection gets in check, I will head home. I recall the way Arctic geese drop down to accompany the sick and the injured until the birds pass or improve. Only then do the companion geese rejoin the flock. And her infection passes. I know something will be back. Something will get all of us, just not today. I say my goodbyes and try to make it like any other day, but I try to remember her face as it is, in case today is the last day. I board the plane. As it takes off, we lift out of Seattle's gray cloud bank and hover far above the city's clouds, now flooded in sunshine. I can't really explain it, but amid the sunshine, I feel somehow turned toward life in a way I don't remember ever feeling. None of what happened here is good news, but I feel touched by the fleeting nature of what I hold dear. I just want to eat up everything I can while I'm still here. I want to eat big meals, run long distances, and have a really good laugh. I act on the urge to ring up people I haven't spoken to in ages. Life is calling to me stronger than ever, like wild geese. Chapter 87, Cord Cutting. Purpose: a virtual boundary establishing exercise to beat all boundary exercises. A shamanic practice of literally cutting your energetic cord with another. Duration: takes 3 seconds. Correction: something like a decade and 3 seconds. Equipment needed: a vivid mind's eye. Age: 40 plus. I've decided from here on to make this my permanent age. Relationship status: single and happy. Not happy to be single or unhappy to be single. Happy, single, two separate facts. Cost: financially free. Emotionally, depends on the relationship. Location: Boulder, Colorado. But technically, this is the locationless location of all locations. The internet: everywhere, somewhere, nowhere. Idiot compassion: something we do a lot of and call it compassion. It's the tendency to give people what they want because you can't bear to see them suffering. Instead of offering a friend medicine, bitter though it may be when ingested, you feed them more poison. At the very least, you don't take it away from them. This is not compassion at all. It's selfishness, as you're more concerned with your own feelings than attending to your friend's actual needs. Pema Chodron. For the longest time, I wanted to think of myself, not that I would admit this, as the Mother Teresa of ex-wives. It was really important to me that Tim think well of me. Perhaps, and I can barely admit this to myself, I wanted the last word, which was silently, despite all the shattered trust from Hookergate and the level of risk you exposed me to, I will show you that I am kind until the end. And I hope that makes you feel bad. Maybe I wanted to out-nice him. Sometimes I thought that's what I was doing. Other times, I just think I possess a hearty dose of understanding. The world is not easy, and some of us, injured in deep, early ways from which recovery may be impossible. I hope he is not in that group. Mostly, I didn't think Tim should be punished more than the internal torment he was likely still living, day in, day out, with a problem so much larger than himself. And I truly still love this man, flaws and all. I had grown up with him. It was complex, and yet, still that simple. But I wondered if I had taken the Mother Teresa possible ego trip in my own mind thing too far. Somewhere between me and me, it had been more important to be likable than authentic. And between me and me, I wasn't sure I liked that about me. For whom was my continued friendship with Tim? For me? For him? Did it even make sense in this stage of my life? Did I even want it? Did he? Or was he staying friends out of guilt, and I was just dragging him through some occasional social niceties so I could feel all good about myself, all puffed up like a blowfish, like no matter what, I was kind? I suspected as such. Yuck. So I changed my mind. And through my travels, I had harnessed enough of myself to do so. Quietly, on a day like any other day, in a gesture far more powerful to me than our divorce, I cut ties. From the cutting of an invisible cord that still connected us in my mind's eye to the social feeds we even just lightly shared. I imagine he didn't even notice. I just slipped away. I wished him no antagonism, quite the opposite. I knew that our time, or better said, my time, was done. I had loved him deeply, and love him still. But that day, I laid down the burden of helping him peripherally navigate his life. Not that he asked me to do that exactly. It's just we never figured out new terms, how or why, to be in each other's lives after a rupture like that. Not a lot of closure there, so I made my own. Now, with all I knew of myself, I no longer needed to be his friend in any public way. And if laying down my Mother Teresa habit eased some or any of his pain and my idiot compassion, all the better. I know what we had, know how I behaved, and am proud, albeit critical, of all I tried. And I know he tried his best too. Truly, he gave what he could, the best that he could, and I him. Phil taught me that. I know he is a beautiful man, an accomplished man, a kind man, a lying man, a playful man, a dedicated man, a secretive man, a generous man, a haunted man, an intelligent man, a sensitive man, and like all of us, flawed. And now he was an important man in my life to whom I could say goodbye. I felt born again and also as if something had died. Some tether loosened and I let it go. Like cutting an internal cord, a brain wire, a snip, out there in the ether. On Tim's and my first trip to Patagonia, we were part of a river rescue. At a crucial part of the river crossing, the rope that was to pull the stranded students to our side of the river fell right out of their hands, and we watched that tiny cord float down the river, untethered to anything or anyone. One minute, I was holding the rope. The next minute, it was gone. Chapter 88. Sing Hymns. Purpose. Not what you'd think exactly. Duration. In this case, less than an hour. Equipment needed. A computer that can both play music and display lyrics, like a karaoke hymnal. Age, 40 plus. Relationship status. I've started mulling about thawing an egg. In the meantime, I still love dog parenting my furry four-legged. She has personality bursting at the seams of her curly self. If she were a tarot card, she might be the trickster, helping me not take myself too seriously. Cost. More plane tickets. 3, to be exact. Location. Whidbey Island, Washington. My father is flying up to see Mom. He did not ask. He announced. What he means by this is he will fly up with Margie for an administration of Christian Science at Mom's bedside. Despite it coming from a well-meaning place in them, it's hard not to feel the unspoken sentiment, which is, if Mom still practiced Christian Science, she wouldn't have run into this tricky Alzheimer's business in the first place. He doesn't say this, but this is what he thinks and plans to remedy. I know him. When it comes to Dad and Mom, I live not only as the nosy eavesdropper on their endless, velvety chair talks, but as a self, or de facto, appointed intermediary. And in my pursuit of balance between them, it usually seemed more important to help Dad hear Mom than the reverse. That was my bias. And so, for good or bad, I've acted as my mother's energetic interpreter. When they get here, Renee says, pausing to take a sip of wine over her fabric table. She's sipping and measuring. I get the feeling we're going to quilt and coterone our way through this thing. 22 table runners and counting. 2 runners for Mom each month. This one is 4th of July flags. I say, whatever gets you through. I just can't, she trails off, moving pieces of fabric out of the way for another pour. I look at her handiwork. An interesting Americana theme is starting to emerge. Benjamin Franklin placemats, George Washington quote posters, Glenn Beck t-shirts. What with her newish love of guns and flags, there's something here about her sense of security. I'm mulling what it means. She hadn't made a firearm quilt yet. I'm tempted to request one. But this is not a time to poke the bear in the zoo. I nominate you to talk to Dad. You're better at these things, Renee says. This is one time I wish we didn't agree. When it comes to Dad, I will say the uncomfortable things that Renee cannot or will not say. When it comes to Dad, I'm the emperor has no clothes kid. I'm the joker in the king's court, whose job it is to give the king the bad news as kindly and as likably as I can. When it comes to Dad. And now, Dad is coming. I talk to Mom in her little room, still struggling to keep her fluids down and do things like negotiate a straw with that mini neck brace. So, Dad is coming. He'd like to see you. He's bringing Margie. What do you think? It's up to you. I can manage it. She takes a large sigh, looks around the room. Her eyes fill with tears of sadness and complication, still aware of herself as the spouse who was left. And yet there's a tether between them, and only she and he truly know its shape. Is it curly, knotted, kinked, taut, shredded? 35 years and 2 children. She looks at me, takes another big breath. Yes, she says. He can come. When Mom moved to the farm, Dad and Margie had sent her a huge, fancy rooster plate. They'd heard she got chickens, so they sent the plate. Mom didn't know what to do with it. For years, she kept it. And then, I don't remember the trigger, was it the photograph they sent of the two of them at her old home on Lake Tahoe? Or the way he insisted he bring all Margie's children and spouses we'd yet to meet to Renee's farm wedding, despite polite discouragement on behalf of Renee's wishes? Or the way he gave the tour of the barn Mom and I built as if it were his by extension? All I know is, at some point, Mom grabbed the rooster plate and, with all the force her dainty self could muster, she threw it to the ground, sending shattered pieces flying. And because she never leaves a mess, proceeded to go in search of the broom and dustpan. And now they were to visit. Yes, he can come, but I would only like to see him. I totally get it, Mom. I've got this. Nausea, a broken neck, fading words, intermittent vomiting, infections they don't believe in, antibiotics they wouldn't take, the humiliation of their judgment on disease hovering above all of us, a broken hip, incontinence, and now a visit from her former husband and his unrequited college love he planned to marry even before his divorce was final. 2 days later, Dad and Margie have cozied into the guest room of Renee's home. He is to head over directly. I hear the door. It's not just him, but them. The one thing Mom had not agreed to. Hi, Dad. Hi, Margie. So nice to see you both. This is true when viewed with a wide-angle lens, less true with a zoom. My job just got 10 times harder. Margie takes my hand and squeezes. Christian scientists don't typically ask after someone who is ill because it means you're buying into this illness stuff. So they don't ask how Mom is doing. She squeezes my hand some more. So nice to see you too, dear Meg. She means it. She has a big smile, lots of sparkle in her eyes, and cheerful laugh lines framed by her stylish blonde coif. Despite not seeing the world as she sees it, I've always respected her lifetime of religious orthodoxy. She studies every day. But this seems an onslaught of misplaced intentions. I look down at her hands as she holds mine tightly. I see her large emerald wedding ring glinting in the light of the narrow hallway of the care facility. I think of the tiny emerald ring and only jewelry my dad ever bought my mom. It's a tiny chip. Mom loved that tiny emerald. Well, here's the thing, Dad, Margie. I believe you mean well. But Margie, as I explained previously, Mom prefers to just see Dad. I hope you understand. Yes, honey, whatever your mom needs. Oh, Megan, that's just baloney, Dad pushes back, all powerful 230 pounds and 6 feet of him towering over me. She is my wife, and we want to come say hello. Don't get so dramatic. That's just bunk. Let's all move beyond that. Dad, I'm not being dramatic. I'm just representing what Mom has told me. We want to come in. Don't dwell on that old stuff. He says stuff like it's toxic waste. His angry voice. I'm not dwelling. I'm trying to respect two points of view, and one of them doesn't feel well right now. Wait one moment, Dad. And again, Margie, I mean no disrespect. It's just up to Mom. Of course, honey. But she does not leave. If I were her, I would have gone and sat in the living room out of respect. Instead, the two of them stand there holding hands. I return to Mom. Mom, he wants to bring in Margie too. Mom sighs, then sighs some more. Her eyes look around the room. Just tell them they can come in, she whispers. I can just tell them to go, I say. Or give him the choice to see you alone or not at all. Really, it's up to you. Let them in. She looks like she's going to cry, but doesn't. I search her eyes, touch her tired face. Okay, I utter. I let the dam go, or the floodgates, or the barrier, or whatever I might be obstructing between Dad and Mom. Perhaps this is their karma, their path. Maybe this is a completion they've needed. I kiss her head and exit to get them, so whatever is to happen can happen. My father gusts by me, his ever-present yellow tablet of notes in hand. Margie follows. In moments, they're at Mom's side, no makeup, hair brushed back, her face gray. The twinkle she normally has, absent. And they start. About principle and truth, all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation. Margie takes my mother's hand and closes her eyes while she talks. Mom looks uncomfortable. Dad? I ask. Any chance you have those gorgeous Christian Science hymns with you? Maybe this could work. Mom and Dad used to sing together. Not hymns, but it's gotta be preferable to this. My father snaps out of his talk and, to my eye, condescension toward the woman on the bed. The broken neck, the brain, the hip, all because, in his mind, she lost connection to divine truth. I do, actually. I have some hymns on my computer, his boyish voice back with excitement. I think that would be wonderful. Singing can be quite a healing. Why don't we all sing? My mother looks at me and then back at them and breathes a little easier. If I'm about to traumatize her, I hope to minimize it. So I hoist an attentive Isabel onto the bed for Mom to feel next to her. Isabel curls up and, as if reading my mind, starts nuzzling Mom's hand to instigate some behind-the-ear scratches. On instinct, Mom starts a gentle pet. Both look more peaceful now, despite the awkward company and sterile surroundings. Dad heads back out of the room toward the car and computer, and Margie and I wait for the hymns. We sing. One in the freedom of the truth, the freer step, the fuller breath. I try to figure how few hymns we need to make them feel heard and how many she can tolerate if they're upsetting to her. I go with three. For a moment, Dad leans down and talks just to Mom, and I hope they have a special moment of peace. With my eye still on my parents, Margie leans into me and says softly, "You know, your mother can be healed from this in Christian Science. It is a science, you know. And in this science, we understand that there is no separation from God." Yes, I say. Thank you so much, Margie. And from the Christian Science view, isn't it true that we are all whole, perfect, and complete at all times? Yes, Megan. Well then, my mom is whole, perfect, and complete exactly as she is. Chapter 89. Trudge through the rain. Purpose. Transition my family. Duration. A month plus. Equipment needed. Moving materials. Tape and the like. Age 40 plus. Relationship status. Single. I've seen some dating action. A few wooers. A whitewater boater. A fighter pilot. The first likes PBR and a green leafy plant a little too much for my taste. I don't need to substitute one man's compulsions for another. The pilot will be a lifelong friend, because honestly, can you see me as a military wife? Employment. Aspiring writer with bridge jobs. Renee is buying the farm from Mom. I will receive a portion of the sale. I'm putting it into an Airbnb multi-unit operation, larger than what I've already been doing. I think Mom would approve, hosting both travelers and people in transition. This is a more profitable profession to combine to make writing possible. Plus, the space designing comes naturally to me. I've landed a few design covers. Location, Whidbey Island, Washington. It's raining on Whidbey Island, and I'm packing up boxes. I'm here at my mother's house. I'm packing up all that she's left behind. She never got that modern, woodsy refuge for women she imagined. Renee and I couldn't sustain the dream. Well, at least not together. It became more about how to not let this fairy tale spot fall apart without going bankrupt. We attempted to shape the place as a wedding venue, but when discussions about where to move the couch became the Battle of Stalingrad, I knew that without Mom, the together farm would never be. Instead, it became about where to put the new dishes my mother kept buying for the gatherings she would never have. That's one of the things the plaque tangles did to her. She couldn't stop buying dishes. So I want very few of those newer stacks and stacks of tangled plaque dishes. Hurts too much. But before I leave, I will style the barn, her barn, our barn, and the wooded landscape that surrounds it in the way I believe she would have wanted. It will be impermanent, a temporary exhibit. And I will take pictures and get it on the cover of a magazine. Isabel will grace the cover too. We photograph it all. The picnics we never had. The piles of cheeses and fruit on vintage linens we never laughed around. Campfires we never lit. Marshmallows we never roasted. I will style gorgeous pretend fresh eggs from imagined chickens pretending they live in the old coop. I will drag out every extra Hoosier cupboard and strange object that my mother bought from a dead woman she never knew but heard about from one of those lawyers who wants to make money on elderly clients, no matter the harm. Tables, chairs, portraits of this stranger, even her shoes. I should say shoe. My mother also bought one singular shoe from this old woman, courtesy of the scoundrel attorney, straight out of the children's story, loyal to her books to the end. Mom, why just the one shoe? Well, because I couldn't buy two. She says this like it's the most logical thing in the world, and in a certain light, it is. I will send these pictures of the life that never happened here to the young architect Thomas, who loved this place. Like Renee, he married here too. He deserves to see it as we envisioned. I don't want him to feel the residue of her illness on his work. I think she would want to give him the vision come to life, if only for a moment. Mom lives down the road now at the care facility where they dress her and feed her and brush her teeth and give her pills and sit her in front of the TV. I hate the place. She's too alone. My sister loves it. It's close. And this is one thing we needed lawyers to talk about and never found a compromise. But where I pack is the farm that my mom can no longer even imagine still exists. And so I'm wrapping up stacks and stacks and stacks of dishes and vases and containers and tiny trinkets that meant something to her once. I will not save the newer ones, only the ones I believed truly matter to her. It's raining on Whidbey Island, and I'm packing up silver. The silver that told us when a special event was really special. It doesn't feel so special holding it now. I think I count 7 butter knives, and I don't eat butter. And only 6 escargot forks, but I don't eat snails. I'm to be out of here by the 31st. Not that I ever lived here, but traces of me did. And now all those traces need to be sorted, packed, labeled and stacked, and put in a pod. That's how moving works now. It's about pods. I'm to put these echoes of a life in this pod and make it all invisible. No trace of me or these objects by the 31st. Put into boxes and tubs and labeled like it all makes sense, even though none of it makes any sense. She's still alive and living down the road, but that's how the disease works. You say goodbye to those with it. You say goodbye to them in pieces. It's raining on Whidbey Island, and I'm packing up Beatrix Potter dish sets. Renee and her family will be moving in by the 31st, and she will call this place home. I'm happy for her, but that does not translate, and so Renee wants all traces of me gone by the 31st. I don't know why this is, it just is. I suspect I'm a safe place to pack the anger, a reminder of a family that got fractured by divorce, by disease, and one particular face, mine, and hers to me, an echo of that family that didn't quite work. It's raining on Whidbey again, and I'm packing up wedding china. I'm splitting up gray and white plates with tiny pink flowers, almost Asian in their delicacy. Mom loved those tiny pink flowers, delicate like the heart she kept so hidden, delicate and wrapped in bubble wrap to prevent breakage. I'm packing up boxes and cooking big vegetable meals for the woman who spends the most time with my mother, a Buddhist named Heidi. I have to feed somebody who needs to eat. I need to have good memories of this kitchen that never got used as it was designed. Mom got sick first. And this fine woman for whom I cook, she takes my mother to the library for new books that my mother can no longer read but recognizes the covers. She takes my mother on undersized walks. You can hardly call them walks anymore. She takes my mother on small shuffles to and from the car. I couldn't make this woman enough food to thank her. I serve these meals on Beatrix Potter plates. I want to put a new memory or two to these plates. I will load up Peter Rabbit and Benjamin Bunny with piles of kale and chard. I'm packing up boxes. Now of Christmas dishware and Ms. Tiggy Winkle tea sets, for a childhood that is no longer mine. I wrap these dishes in bubble wrap and wonder if I will ever have the sort of life that gathers large groups around a holiday table with Christmas tree plates. My Christmases don't so much look like that, and I wonder why that is. I wonder if I mind. I am not yet packing up the blue and white Meissen china, so it sits out. My sister has divided it in half but covered it all with Post-its, labeling dish subgroups with codes marked A, B, C, D, and E. It appears I'm to do something about these groups according to some secret division system only Renee understands. I don't know what any of these Post-its mean. Her order doesn't match how my brain works. Never has. And so I will repile the dishes without subgroups and Post-its, and this will offend her, and I will feel bad about it. And so I will leave out my redivision for her approval, and she will disapprove. That's how it's mostly gone. I've never fit neatly into a subgroup, but not for a lack of trying. I can tell you, I stared at those Post-its for a good long while, trying to decipher their meaning, all the while wondering how her language became the one I tried so hard to defer to, and why mine has so often repelled. Instead, I now pack up my Uncle Ted's cutting board, which he made in the shape of a pig in a wood shop. My mother had him autograph it because it was one of the only things he made with his hands other than laying bricks. She couldn't take her brother's bricks with her, so I pack the pig. I won the pig when the lawyers flipped a coin for who got what object. Yes, it came to lawyers and lists in order of priority and coin tosses, an expensive way to divvy up stuff, especially when none of it really seems to matter. My mother is gone. the part that cared about dishes and rabbits and cutting boards, is gone. And I'm packing it all up anyway. Maybe someday I will cut vegetables on my Uncle Ted's pig. I add the tiny milk pitchers and large colored goblets from a trip to the Madonna Inn, quite possibly the tackiest place on earth. I can picture Christmas with the tacky glasses easier than the Christmas tree plates. The goblets are so ugly, so garish and bright. I find them beautiful. I don't know why life is asking me to release those I have held most dear. A fading mom, a distant sister. But it is. It is asking me to do this. This life is asking me to do this, and I am obeying. And hoping some new version of us will rise up like a phoenix from the ash. I'm packing up boxes slowly. I've never been particularly good at goodbyes, and I'm doing it anyway. Despite being awkward and clumsy and having to say it more than once. When it all gets too much, I put down the bubble wrap. When it all gets too much, I get in the wagon Mom used to drive and pull up to her care facility where she lives. I often bring Isabel. The only thing I like about the place is that they understand how much four-legged friends help their residents. I knock on the door and head in, where she is watching The Sound of Music again. It's a good story, she says, petting Isabel while she watches. Wait 2 minutes. It's a good story, she says again. Everything works out in The Sound of Music. The whole family climbs that damn euphoria-inducing happy hill and escapes the Nazis together. The care provider, Kathy, tells me she cared for the youngest von Trapp after she suffered a stroke. She says at the end, the woman, I think it was Gretel, had no contact with her family. I guess a few things happened they didn't cover in the movie. So when I'm not packing up boxes or driving her old car or running trails with my furry sidekick to shake these blues and mean reds, I'm at the facility climbing in next to my mother on her Tempur-Pedic adjustable bed. Sometimes life changes on a dime and you just can't make sense of it. I'm a happy person, but this is not happy. I am often a joyful person, but today I do not feel joy. I laugh a lot now in my normal life, but today is not normal. These are sad parts that I will pack up and try not to let linger longer. I don't need to make these grooves of loss any deeper than they are. They are deep enough. I haven't forgotten that despite the rain on Whidbey, the rain over the Olympic Mountains, the rain in the North Cascades, it is sunny many places I love other than right here. It is sunny in the Wind River Range of Wyoming, and in Watamu, Kenya, and in Newport Beach, California, and on my new pint-sized porch in New York City. And I will return to those places once the boxes are stacked and potted. I will try to trust that one day I will get to love and be loved by a man again. The mom thing? I don't know where that love goes, only that this is not how I want it. I will tell myself I have too much love to give to not share, and I hope myself will believe it. I will tell myself to insist that all this tenderness goes somewhere good, to someone who knows he wants it. And I will tell myself more than once in hopes it will stick, that just like the rain that falls to the ground, love has its own natural course, that I can remember how it moves outward from my chest, and can touch and be touched. I tell myself it will work like that again, that my heart will not live a life in bubble wrap. I tell myself that my heart likes the sun too much, the fresh air too much, the heat, and I hope myself will believe that too. In the meantime, I will love on my mother, even though she may no longer recognize the timbre of my voice or the nose on my face. For all this forgetting, my mom's disease would come in handy. But you can't retrofit it. It doesn't let you pick and choose the memories to take with you and those to leave behind. I kiss my mother on the cheek and head back to my boxes. I will let her get back to Maria and the Baroness. Like I said, I'm not so good at goodbyes, especially with her. I don't know why life comes in waves like this. Like it's saying, just free fall. Let go and let what is meant to come to you, come. Let it take you. You can't wrap it all up, it says. It tells me some things will be broken, others lost. Not everything can be shipped off in a pod. Some residue will linger. She will linger. But sometimes, to get back to the brightest of light, you must trudge for a bit through the rain. And sometimes, you must do so alone. I look down at my pile of empty boxes I have yet to fold and tape like stiff origami. I know only two things to be true at this large kitchen table of objects yet to be sorted. I have no box for her, to keep her safe, to keep me safe. So free fall, please take me. For now, you will be my lover, my teacher, my workshop, my mother, my companion. We will travel for a spell. I fall willingly, but if you can, please fast-track me, quick as a bunny. I believe I have a plate of hers somewhere here that says just that, quick as a bunny. Wait 1 second, and I will show you. Ground. And now, cried Max, let the wild rumpus start. Maurice Sendak. They say things happen in threes. I don't know if it's true, but I know how soothing it can feel to find those arcs within our own lives, with three of anything making it possible to feel a beginning, a middle, an end. They can help give one a sense of completion, to make sense of the difficulties. My arc came in fours. My beloved four-legged Isabel has died. And with this, I no longer feel that wordless, albeit very communicative, furry companion riding next to me, nearly always shotgun in my car, or curled at my feet on planes, or tucked behind my knees in the middle of the night when we both sleep. She can no longer make her playful, wagging introductions everywhere we go, splaying her belly to strangers at any bookstore or hiking trail or city street, hoping for a rub or a scratch to her perfectly pink tummy. Her cancer came fast and hard. Coco and her husband were with us when she passed, Isabel curled in my lap, taking her last breath. We lit candles and said things we thought she would want to hear, or that we needed to say. And not knowing anything concrete about an afterlife, and because I wanted to cover all the bases that mean something to me, we sat both Shiva in the Jewish tradition and followed Buddhist practice for the deceased. For Shiva, we covered mirrors, sat low to the ground, and in Buddhist fashion, we didn't move her little brown body for 3 days. Buddhist thinking suggests this helps the spirit of a sentient being travel as it needs, by keeping the body as still and quiet as possible. My childhood friend Nessa would check in now and then, making sure I didn't get too comfortable spooning, in her words, a dead dog. By the morning of the fourth day, Isabel's presence actually felt different. On that fourth, she now felt like a body, not like a soul. This made it far easier for me to bring her to the crematorium where the undertaker explained how it would all work, the temperature, the time it would take, what would remain, all to transform her into ash with her favorite stuffed froggy next to her. As for the second, my father's kind wife, Margie, the devout Christian scientist, has Alzheimer's. Not that she will ever call it that, nor will my father. Nor will I ever push to label it as such, but a far too familiar disease process is passing through our family again. I am heartbroken for them both. She has loved my father deeply and well, and he, her. They are going on 20 years of marriage, but he's loved her far longer. The disease is moving faster with her. Margie would never take a medication for a condition she doesn't believe in. So without ever giving the situation a name, I can still love on her. I know how to help support her through the confusion, and I know a thing or two about how to help Dad navigate this loss, as I have learned via trial by fire how to get through. From my point of view, my father sits with this all in an awkward place, between refusing to acknowledge that something is happening, yet having to vent and plan and work to help his loved one when things he says aren't happening are happening. All this is softening my father. With this new challenge, he needs friendship, a laugh, a break. To tell a difficult story to a non-denying ear. And I want to, and do, offer that help wherever I can. For now, it is dealing with the level of one who can't remember how to put together a puzzle, or forgets whether a bath mat goes inside or outside a shower, or whether we just ate, or where someone has just been yesterday, or where they will go tomorrow. And if or when she worsens, I will be there for both of them as she forgets how to dress, to talk, to feed herself. I'm open to a miracle. I just don't think that's how it will go. Regardless, I will never say, see, there are some things that even the most dedicated of religions can't protect you from. What I will say instead is, Margie, Dad, tell me about your favorite hymns. I would love to sing them for you. This next one has no number. My mother has passed. As with Isabel, I was with her there too. Down to the last days, she could still respond to yes or no questions with a blink system she and I developed. Very long, deliberate winks for a yes. Are you scared? I asked. Yes, she said, with one decidedly lengthy close of her eyes. When I asked, are you ready to go? She answered with a far more tentative blink. But that made sense to me, to be less sure of a decided end. After the first night that we thought she was near the very end, with her fluid-filled breaths and huge silences between those breaths, Renee and I spooned one another through the night next to Mom's bed in a wildly uncomfortable lazy boy. By morning, Renee and I watched a giant bald eagle perch in the yard of the care facility for a half hour. When I answered a call from Coco while we watched Mom's power animal, Renee told me, "The eagle took a huge dump just as you answered the phone. Mom hated when Dad took his phone calls. I think she's telling you to get off the phone." "Don't you think we're taking this eagle thing a tiny bit too literally?" I asked. We giggled, then laughed hysterically. It felt good. And then the final day came. Somehow, we knew that this was the day. Renee sat meditating and in prayer in the lazy boy, and I searched for Mom's and my shared favorite song, Sarah McLachlan's I Love You. As I pushed play and the song began, her breaths got further and further apart still. We went from our chairs to her bed. Renee sat on her left, holding Mom's hand, and I sat on her right with my hand on Mom's heart. Her breaths became wider and wider still. So wide, I was sure no human could hold her breath that long. "She's going," I said. "I know," Renee said. And then she took that last breath to the song's words, "I forgot to tell you I love you." Her eyes rolled up and to the left. Renee and I curled up around her and cried in silence for the next 2 hours, holding her, holding each other, playing softly all the music that reminded us of her, her most beloved songs. As for her memorial, we made her favorite books as centerpieces, stacked and tied in giant burlap bows, Berry Lopez and Blueberries for Sal. By the end of her life, when Mom couldn't recall any names, she still wanted to speak of Lopez. She called him our man, and I always knew of whom she spoke. We only had one. For the walls, we hung a quilt of Mom's favorite books that Renee had made. Mom's vintage toys and figurines of Beatrix Potter, Winnie the Pooh, and other characters made a beautiful showing on the tables, welcoming guests and old friends from nearly every modality she ever tried, from Christian Science to Lawrence Studies to the children's bookshop. For her, I invited Tim, which felt right. He declined with a very kind note about her, which felt right too. The eulogy that slayed me was unexpected, as if it emerged from the ether. I suppose the best ones do. It was given by the librarian, a veritable stranger, from the abused children's home out in the desert. She still ran the program my mother built and had made it flourish. Mom had charged this woman with a new idea, that a trip to the library and a book weren't just a reward, but could help heal what's broken. It was like our man had taught us. Sometimes people need a story more than food to stay alive. The librarian spoke of the ripple effect one ordinary person could have on so many. In this case, it was my mother. And the librarian wasn't just talking about the kids. She was talking about herself. She couldn't stop crying. It felt as if her gratitude came from that deepest well, the one where you feel the generations of all who came before you in your bones. Mom, who had driven out to the desert week after week, having never been asked, started with just a little box of books and a story hour. To the librarian, it was as if she'd said, "Take this, run with this, run with this, and then fly." Alexa says Mom came to the memorial and that she loved it. I like to imagine she was there, cross-legged with the Maharishi. Alexa says now her energy will visit me when I am doing something particularly creative. I like to imagine this too. As for the fourth, now 2 months after my mother has passed, Phil has told me he is retiring as a therapist. 9 years of work together coming to an end. In all ironies, as I am learning to land, Phil wants to spend the next phase traveling with his wife, no longer defining his primary role in the world as a therapist, nor primarily rooted in one geographic location. But for the first time in my adult life, in the face of these changes, I have my own center to which I can return and invite others into as well. This center comes in the shape of a perfectly round house. I have built myself a yurt alongside 12 other yurts surrounded by Grand Teton National Park. It's quite beautiful. Beautiful enough that a new resort ranch has asked me to design a group of them in the Wasatch Mountains. Now, the fact that I choose to reside in a structure created and used by a nomadic people scattered across Mongolia, this irony is not lost on me. I'm doing my best here. Perhaps it also made landing more gentle that I raised my yurt in the wilds of Wyoming, the landscape of my mother's most precious dreams. But my version has more unexpected delights than either of us could have imagined. I am surrounded not just by the pack of rescued dogs she imagined, but by elk, bison, moose, coyote, wide-braided streams, spectacular night skies, and a perfectly framed view out my window of the 7,000-foot rise of the jagged, young, and majestic Grand. I often wake with the sun streaming through the dome and end with the moon cresting over a late-night fire, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends and family passing through. I have the coziest little guest tent to welcome those as I have been welcomed, like Coco in Fort Collins and Michelle and Scott in Lander and Nessa in Newport. It's a good spot. What Wyoming may lack in convenience, it makes up for in large, open spaces. Tonight, it's a full house. Dinner on the deck in the height of summer. A strand of Italian twinkly lights. Bellies full of pesto pasta and giant hot chocolates. A small constellation of friends dots my camp. Michelle and Scott have turned off the small chandelier in the guest tent. Their young daughter Magda reads by headlamp on my couch inside the yurt. And the last, a new friend, is deckside, curled up in the womb cocoon of his sleeping bag, his face under the stars, embarking on his very own first solo astro bivvy. I am honored that he chose this spot for his first bivvy. Protection, nourishment, comfort. In the end, it's not that complicated. P.S. I did the Hoffman process. Couldn't help myself. Loved it. To anyone still listening to this, whatever poem, painting, invention, cartoon, picture, recipe, purpose, story, mission, obsession, garden, flowchart, novel, whatever idea so special that you are maybe even too nervous to talk about, just know that the world is calling to you to bring to life your treasure, whatever that may be. Only you know. So get going. We can't wait to feel it. This is Megan Griswold. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Help, a memoir in remedies. This program was directed by Alan Tobin. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2019 by Megan Griswold. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.